Welcome to the Film for Fans podcast, a podcast from movie fans for movie fans. I'm your host, Ryan Dunleavy. That is my co-host, Rob Dunham.
Raise the Jolly Roger, etc.
Rob is very happy that has seen his Pirates team has seen above 500 this late in the season.
It's miraculous, and it is depressing that I'm so excited about being three games above 500. We're only a third of the way through the baseball season. That's rough. That's rough.
Hey, take what you can get. However, this is not a baseball podcast today. It is, in fact, a movie podcast. We're excited about what we have in store for you. We are going to, of course, break down the box office from the last week. And our discussion for this week is movies turning 15. That's right, movies from 2011. So that should be a fun discussion. And we'll close out with our watch list, movies that we've watched over the last, well, couple weeks, because we've been a little bit absent from the podcast, unfortunately. But we are back. And we're going to have fun. You ready to do this, Rob?
I am ready.
Bring it on. All right. So jumping into the box office results from this past weekend. And I was debating about whether to go with the weekend because the comparable stats are the full Memorial Day weekend stats, but I just did the Memorial Day weekend stats. Number one is Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu. $98 million for it. Yeah, we'll talk about that. So that Mandalorian and Grogu finished with number one with $98 million in its first week in the box office. Number two was Obsession, finished with $31.98 million in its second week in the box office. Michael, in its fifth week in the box office, did $27.1 million. The Devil Wears Prada. By the way, Michael has a five-week total of $321 million for the Michael Jackson biopic. $321 million. Yeah. The Devil Wears Prada 2, $16.5 million in week four. That movie has made $199 million. So we're coming up on $200 million mark for Devil Wears Prada 2. That's impressive. $12.3 million for The Sheep Detectives in week three. That movie has made $46.8 million to round out the top five. All right, Rob, what do you make?
So I have seen all of these except for the number one grossing movie. So, yeah, we haven't had a chance to talk since I've seen Obsession, I don't think. Or have we talked? I don't think I've talked about The Sheep Detectives either, have I?
What?
The Sheep Detectives?
No.
So, yeah, I'll have thoughts about those when we get to our watch list.
Okay.
I will say this. I'm surprised Obsession has made that much money. And I'll talk more about that when we get to the watch list.
Yeah.
So what has it made in 2 weeks then?
2 week total for Obsession is $62.3 million.
Wow. So it pretty much held steady from week one to week two.
Yeah. Now you got an extra day thrown in there. So that's where they don't actually have the change versus last week.
Yeah.
Because it's not apples to apples. But yeah, it basically.
I mean, that means it's gotten pretty amazing word of mouth if it's staying that steady even with the extra ball.
Yeah, it basically doubled from week one to week two.
Yeah. Mandalorian, I bet they were hoping for a lot more than that.
It is, in fact, the lowest grossing opening for a Star Wars movie of all time. So, yeah, I did see this, and so I can talk about that in our watch list segment.
So I have not seen it yet, but I am not surprised by that, because I felt like watching the trailers that it seemed like it was just going to be a long episode of the show. I'm interested in what your actual thoughts are. I'm still am going to see it. My wife and kids want to see it, but I've not seen it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Devil Wears Prada 2 raking in. That type of movie doing $200 million is impressive.
Yeah.
That's very impressive, especially I think it speaks to the fact that the sequel did a good enough job of creating some momentum of its own and an original film, not just the nostalgia play. Because a film like that, the nostalgia play works for like opening weekend, but that's it. And this has stayed fairly steady at this
Yeah,
still.
I'm guessing with the results from Michael, the second movie will end up being made. They kind of threw, I think we did talk about this, they threw in a tagline at the end of the credits, like last minute, like it was in the last week before it was released, saying his story continues, because they were considering possibly coming out with a sequel. This did well enough, and I'm thinking it probably well enough. Now the question is, what exactly is going to be in the sequel? Because there's a lot of conjecture that it's going to be a lot of the bad stuff. People are going to want to spend their money to go watch a movie about bad stuff, is the question. And what legally will they actually be able to show? It's the other question.
Because once you get past basically where they are, then everything starts getting pretty fraught. The Michael Jackson story. So, yeah. Just want to briefly mention, because it is not in the top five. Also included in the top 10, number 9 was Super Mario Brothers. In 8 weeks, it's made $424 million. And Project Hail Mary came in number 10 this week at 3.5 million. In 10 weeks, it's made $340 million. So,
Solid.
yeah, still hanging in there, still kicking out some money. So, any other thoughts on this? We'll obviously cover some of these movies in the watch list. I did see Devil Wears Prada 2 as well.
I also saw that. I don't have any other specific thoughts on that now.
All right. Well then, let's talk briefly about movies that come out this week. There's three movies of note that come out this week. Back Rooms comes out, and Back Rooms is a horror sci-fi film. Chiwetel Ejiofor, which never knew how to pronounce that guy's name. And the tagline here is, "A strange doorway appears in the basement of a furniture showroom." Rated R, 1 hour, 51 minutes. The next film coming out this week is Pressure. And Pressure, PG-13, 1 hour, 40 minutes. In a tense 72 hours before D-Day, the fate of the world hangs in the balance. General Dwight D. Eisenhower and Captain James Stagg face an impossible choice: launch the most dangerous invasion in history or risk losing the war altogether. So we got Andrew Scott, who most notably played Moriarty in the Sherlock films, is in this one. Brendan Fraser plays Ike in this one. Kerry Condon is in it. Chris Messina, Damian Lewis, amongst others. So this is you get a World War II film in there in Pressure. And finally, we get The Breadwinner. This is a Nate Bargatze film, PG. And it doesn't actually say how long it is. The Breadwinner is a comedy, a family comedy that follows the misadventures of Nate Wilcox, whose wife, Katie, played by Mandy Moore, lands a once-in-a-lifetime deal on Shark Tank that takes her on a prolonged business trip, and now the lifelong breadwinner has to fend for his family as the first-time stay-at-home dad. So, yeah. So you got Nate Bargatze, Mandy Moore, Colin Jost as well. So you got a comedy in there, a family comedy as well. Any of those interest you, Rob?
I am very interested in both Pressure and Backrooms. When the first time I saw a trailer for Backrooms, it's been something I've been very much looking forward to. It's A24. It's weird. It looks original. So I'm very interested in that. And then Pressure, I actually didn't even know about until this last weekend when I saw a trailer for it. And Brendan Fraser has had a little bit of a career resurgence here after coming back from some awful things that happened to him. And I've actually just been watching the Mummy movies too, the Mummy and the Mummy Returns, and watching those has also made me, again, interested in Brendan Fraser. And I really, in general, like this time period in history, World War II.
For sure.
So I'm really interested in seeing the backstory. But the idea here is that it's based on the forecasting and the weather patterns for the D-Day landing, and if it would be safe or not to do it, and if it's safe enough to actually get the fleet over there. And there's a whole lot that went into that. It was not just, hey, let's show up and let's storm this beach. Like, it took months and months of planning, and this last couple of days before it happened were incredibly tense. Well, this was a big part of it, whether or not it would be safe for them to even attempt this. So,
For sure.
because Lee, if you don't know anything about the English Channel and the coast between England and France, it is not a calm area of the water.
No.
So this was a pretty wild idea to begin with, and the fact that so much of this went into pulling it off, I think it's cool that there will be a slightly different take or slightly different aspect that we get to see around the story in this movie.
For sure. Definitely. I'm definitely interested in Pressure, and I'd probably be interested in The Breadwinner. I like Nate Bargatze. We'll see if he can translate his comedy into family fun films. So, yeah. All righty. That is the box office update for the week. Next, we will turn our attention to our discussion, movies turning 15 this year. That is movies from 2011. And 2011 was a pretty good year, I think. And we'll talk in a moment about our thoughts on it generally. Well, yeah, why don't we start there, actually? Give me your overall impression as you look through movies from 2011, trying to find which ones stand out to you. What was your overall take on movies of this particular year?
Yeah, so 2011, you can describe it as a pretty good year for movies, and that's about where I would land. And by that, I mean there are several movies that I really enjoy and would watch multiple times, but there are very few movies that I would say are like classics or tops of their subgenres from this year. I happen to, we'll talk about this, I happen to like the movie that won Best Picture. A lot of people don't or don't understand it at all, which is fair, because it is very not mainstream in any way imaginable. But there's a whole lot of movies that I would say, like, you watch, you're just like, oh yeah, that was good. Interestingly, like, several movies based on adapted material that were quite good. And a couple of original stories that were really good. And another thing that that jumped out to me when I was looking through the release dates of these movies, almost my entire list came out in the very end, like the last 3 months of the year, for 2011, which I found very interesting. In fact, one of my honorable mentions came out December 25th, which kind of stressed the boundaries of it being included on a list of the best movies of 2011, but that's when it was released in the theater.
It
So
came out in 2011.
it goes on the list. And actually, I've had to double check that, because when you look at box office rankings for a year, a lot of times movies will come out at the end of the previous year and they'll make the majority of their money the following year. So they'll be listed on that following year's box office when they're not actually the movies from that year.
Yeah, I
So
got it. There's depending on which site you go on, there's a filter where you can rank them based on movies. Like one of them is like money made that year, and the other one is like released in that year. So that will include money that it made like into the following year.
And one of my movies was released in a different country in 2011 and didn't release in the United States in 2012, but I'm counting it. So
But
deal with it.
okay.
And the reason I am counting it, and I'll go into this when we get a specific movie, is it made the majority of its money overseas. So to me, The release overseas is more important than the release in the United States for that particular movie.
All right, justify putting a terrible movie on there. That's fine. You're good. Yeah, that's all right. I can see the excuse making already. It's okay. So, I think for me, and I said this to you off podcast before we started recording, I feel like there were like 15 movies that were all like 7 to 8.5. So they were all like really solid, really good movies, movies I've watched that I watch and rewatch sometimes, but that you would not consider them like masterpieces or like really something that you will stand out in your top movies of all time list. Now, I will say that as I look over my list, I think my top 4 or 5 all probably have significant notoriety for one reason or another. Probably at least 2, maybe the third one would be on my top list. So I think the top, maybe I'm underrating the top of it, but just a bunch of really solid movies for sure. All right. Well, before we get into our personal lists, let's review this year. I will tell you the main Oscar winners and the top grossing movies. So the main Oscar winners, lead actor was Jean Dujardin for The Artist. We had supporting actor was Christopher Plummer for Beginners. The lead actress was Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady. And supporting actress was Olivia Spencer for The Help. And the director was Michelle Hazanavicius for The Artist. I butchered that terribly. And The Artist did win Best Picture out of that year. I will say, for me, this is just a classic example of the Oscars screwing it up. But, I'll let you disagree with that later. The top grossing movies of the year, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, $381 million. Transformers Dark of the Moon, just trying to forget all of those movies exist, $352 million. Twilight Breaking Dawn, $281 million. Hangover Part 2, $254 million. Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, which is better than I remembered. I need to go back and watch that one. $241 million. So basically all of your top grossing movies were all franchise films, and you were starting to get into the knee-deep era of the franchise film being the box office breadwinners on that one. Do you have any comments on those?
Most of those movies are on my list. So just because it made a lot of money doesn't mean that it was good.
One of those movies is on my top list.
Yeah.
So... all right, let's jump into our list. Give me your honorable mentions. We don't have to spend a lot of time there, but give me your honorable mentions for it.
Honorable mentions. So the one that came out in December was Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close with Tom Hanks, about the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th. This book, Jonathan Safran Foer, is an incredibly powerful book. If you've not read the book, I would recommend that you read the book. The movie and the book are two very different things, because the book is told from one person's perspective and the movie is told from another person's perspective. So it's impossible to judge them against each other because they're two different stories, really. But it's a very emotional movie. If you happen to be alive during that event, it's quite powerful. If you weren't alive during that event, it might be something that'd be worth you watching to give you the perspective of humanity and the event instead of just the news footage, because it's the story of a young boy who loses his father in the attack. And he says in the movie that his father is the falling man, and there's a picture of one of the people who had jumped out of the tower. And that's just... it's devastating if you live through that.
Yep.
And then my other two honorable mentions are complete opposite in feel. And I think that's good. I think we need balance. The one is Hugo, which is the story of a young boy who's living in the clock tower in the train station. Sacha Baron Cohen is in this movie as the station master who's hunting him down. And it's really funny and really heartwarming, heartfelt movie. It's a very good family movie, Hugo. My kids both liked it a lot when they were younger. And then my other one is like a coming of age movie. It's Super 8, J.J. Abrams and Steven Spielberg movie. Really delves deep into the history of self-made film. Super 8 camera is the idea here. And like what happens when you allow yourself to open yourself up to creativity and to like explore. And I think that's something Steven Spielberg has always been quite good at. A lot of his movies kind of go into those themes. And I think Disclosure Day, which is coming out later this year, is going into those kind of themes too, the unknown. And Super 8 does a really good job of like balancing tension, and you're not quite sure what's happening and where things are going. And I thought they made a good combo, Abrams and Spielberg, of filmmakers for this movie in particular. I'm guessing that might be on your list,
Yep.
but I don't know. So those are my three honorable mentions.
All right. Honorable mentions for me, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, based on the John le Carré novel, kind of a classic intellectual spy film. And it's got a very good cast in it as well. So if you like spy genres, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Contagion. I actually used to really like this film. And then, we had a pandemic, and I'm like, eh, I
Yeah.
like going back to this film. But it was a very good film at the time. Good cast, well done. And it's interesting. Some of an actual pandemic played out that way, and some of it didn't.
Yeah.
The Help is on my honorable mentions. Just a really solid film, talking about a specific era and the black servants in white Southern households and some of the things that they went through at that time. X-Men First Class, which I actually, it's one of my favorites of the X-Men series. I do kind of like X-Men First Class a good bit. And then Limitless was another honorable mention with the Bradley Cooper film. I like that concept. Good sci-fi films kind of have, and it's not a ton of sci-fi, but it still has kind of a sci-fi premise where what would happen if this, and then you get to play that out. And of course, in this case, it's what if there was a drug that lets you use your entire brain and what that would look like. So I love how that kind of plays out and that storyline on that one. All right. Without further ado, let's get into our top 10. We will do 10, 9, 8. We'll go three in a row. Rob, what do you got for 10, 9, 8?
All right, so when we do this, I was thinking we'd switch things up a little bit in that when I say the name of mine, you can say yes or no if it's on your list.
Okay.
We can like reveal as we go through.
Sure.
I know my number 10 is not on your list.
It
My number 10 is The Artist,
is not on my list.
which, as we said, won a lot of awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor.
Nobody remembers the film.
It
Nobody does.
is a tribute to silent film. It's got a lot of silence, a lot of subtitles, and a lot of French. And it is for someone like me who enjoys like seeing representations of different eras of film. It's a movie I really liked when it came out. I'm gonna be honest with you, I have not seen it since. So I don't. It's not a movie with staying power, which is the problem with the Academy giving these awards to these movies, because people loved it at the time, and I think most people don't remember it.
Yep.
And it's only on my list because I know that I liked it.
Yeah.
And I honestly, like, I don't know if I'm going to watch it again.
Yeah.
But looking at the list of movies that came out that year, I was like, it's got to be my top 10. But it ended up at number 10. Number nine for me, I'm guessing, is also not on your list. It's The Untouchables from France. This is the movie that came from
No,
France.
I do
So,
remember that one coming out. Yeah, but
yeah,
no.
so it came from France in November. Did not release in the United States until 2012. This movie was remade in the United States as The Upside with Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston. But this one is a lot better. It is heavily in French, so you have to be okay with subtitles. But it's a really great story about two people on the edges of society, one who is disabled, permanently physically disabled, and one who is part of the ghetto in France, in Paris. Both looked down on by almost everyone, and they find a way to connect and help each other and grow together, which I think it was a beautiful story. And it made, I was looking it up, it was like in the top 10 worldwide by the end of the year, but on the back of making over $440 million overseas. So it made almost all its money overseas. But people, I think in France alone, it made something like $300 million. So it made a lot of money worldwide. My number eight, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, is that on your list?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. The thing I appreciate about this movie, having read the book, is how they managed to keep it so close to the book.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about that before. Like, it's very hard. It's almost an impossible task to make a movie line up with a book, just because they're so different as mediums. But this one does just a fantastic job of that. And I think we both have a proclivity towards appreciating Daniel Craig in movies, and I think he does a great job in this movie of being the character. He's not James Bond, he's not any other person, he is this character in this movie. And I really love the tone of the movie. I love how it's shot. It is one I would watch again and have watched again. And I think it's really hard. It'd be really hard to make this kind of movie better. And to me, that's a sign the movie's a good movie. And I mean, it also does have a James Bond intro, but it's not a James Bond movie.
Yes, David Fincher also likes his intro songs, and
Yeah.
this was another film scored by Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor.
All right, that's my 10-9-8. Artist, Intouchables, and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
All right, and you can announce if any of these are on your list. My number 10 is Tower Heist.
Not on my list.
Tower Heist is just a really cool, fun, like comedy, like drama comedy. And Ben Stiller, Casey Affleck are hotel workers, and they're not a hotel. They like run a condo for like that's occupied by millionaires in New York City. And they find out one of the chief occupants of this building has been like embezzling funds, including from their personal pensions, and they launch a plan to get back at him. And it's a cool movie. It's just a fun, enjoyable movie. It's kind of a heist film, kind of a comedy, kind of a buddy cop type thing, but it's not so serious. So it's a cool, fun movie. And so that's why it's number 10 on my list. Have you seen it?
I have, yes.
Okay.
I do like it. Just quite
Yeah.
really come out.
Just didn't quite make the list.
Yeah.
I put number 9 as Captain America, the First Avenger.
That is on my list.
Okay. Yeah. I really enjoyed this one. I go back and I really love some of the early MCU Marvel movies from that first phase. And I think they nailed a lot of the character introductions in some of these. And so this was just a cool, fun movie. You know, you get back to the World War II era and introducing this character. So it's one of the stronger movies for me. I think a lot of the Captain America movies have been some of the stronger entrants in the MCU series. And I think the first one right there was no exception. I think it was one of the best of the first phase. All right. And number 8, The Adjustment Bureau.
That is on my list.
Yeah. I'm surprised this one is this low on my list. I might have to.
I'm surprised this one is this low on your list.
I don't know why it's this low on my list. I actually feel like it should be two spots higher, but it's currently listed at number eight. So I guess I have to go with that because I already said it. But honestly, I think it should come in at least two spots higher for me. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about it now, but it probably should be up at number six for me.
It makes it feel better. It is at number six for me. We'll get there.
So yeah, I'll say it's currently listed at number eight, and I'll talk about it when you talk about it in number six.
Okay.
How about we do that? All
All
right.
right.
Seven,
Number seven
six,
for
five.
me is Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
What's that?
Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes, huh?
Number seven.
Okay. All right.
The reason why this is on my list is because it completely brought new life to the entire series. And James Franco and the writing and Andy Serkis playing Caesar, like everything about this movie is good. And completely, well, I won't say completely, but it erases a lot of the nonsense from the Mark Wahlberg version. It gets back to like they needed to make a version of this movie that was more grounded, as grounded as a movie can be about apes taking over the world.
Yeah.
But there is a really I really like the progression of the storyline in this movie, all the way to the revealing of Caesar like gaining intelligence and taking over and being able to lead this group of apes against the humans. I like how the series progresses. I really like the series in general. There was one that came out a couple years ago that was okay. But it was nowhere on the level of, it was a continuation of the series, but it was nowhere on the level of this first movie. First one is the best one, in my opinion, in this version, this iteration. So that's my number seven. Number six is the Adjustment Bureau. So the Adjustment Bureau, Matt Damon, obviously, and just a really cool, unique perspective on the role of deity and the role of angels and the role of just a whole bunch and free will and just so many things are addressed in this movie. And it is an incredibly deep movie. And I think a movie that might be hard for a lot of people to access because you kind of have to come to it with a certain like base of understanding or the desire to understand, to try to understand questions of morality and free will and choice. And I think it's a movie everybody should see because it really opens up the ability to have those discussions. But it's not a movie that you just sit back and enjoy. Like, it's a movie that requires you to actually think and process. Because no matter where you are on the spectrum of these issues, there are things you're going to agree with in the movie, and there are things you're going to be like, I'm not quite sure how I feel about what they said there. But I like that. I want movies like that. I want to be able to take it and talk to somebody about it and say, hey, what do you think about this? Like, what does this mean for you? What does this mean for Christianity? What does this mean for whatever perspective you're coming from? Because there's something for people from any perspective in this movie, and it's just superbly well executed and took me completely by surprise when I saw it the first time because I was not prepared for the depth of discourse that would be in this movie because it's a Hollywood movie. I would argue I would make an argument. Now, this movie is not made like specifically or intentionally from a Christian perspective, but I would personally, Ryan, make the argument that this might be the best Christian film that I've seen because it really makes you approach and interact with the question.
Yeah. It's certainly a thought-provoking movie for sure. And I think their unique approach to handling it with the chairman and the Adjustment Bureau and those type of things and the questions they raise, I think think do a great job getting you to think along those levels. And I think the concept of a deity comes out very strong in this. And I think it's well written to the point where it's a positive thing, you know, the idea that there is somebody at the top, this chairman, as they call it in the movie, I think is portrayed positively as the movie wears on, especially towards the end, it's given a positive disposition. So I think there's a lot of very good things in this. Not to mention the acting performances are incredible. The sets and the scenery is really, really cool. They pick great locations, great sets. I think one of the things that's key for this movie that makes it work so well is the incredible chemistry between Emily Blunt and Matt Damon. And I think so many movies that could be awesome fall because you don't really buy the love story element. And this one you do. You buy the chemistry. You buy the fact that these two would have this connection to each other that would keep leading them in certain directions, even though they're torn apart multiple times. Like, you buy that completely. And I think that's a tribute to the acting, as well as then you layer on all the philosophical depth that comes on top of that. And there's just the expert filmmaking, the unique and original storyline, the good secondary casting performances is also very cool. So lots of good stuff in that one.
All right, and my number five is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Nice. That is going to be the next one I talk about, so I can talk about that one here as well. So.
Okay. The movie stands not just on its own merit, but on the fact that it is the summation of the entire series. The thing that I really appreciate the most about the series is that you see the growth of the characters throughout. And as the movies progress, they get darker and darker and darker. And part of that is the reality of when you grow, you expose yourself to more scenarios and more points of view and understand more and deeper things. So naturally, the inclination will be to head in that direction. And this movie is obviously just a big finale of all of that. And it is powerful. Obviously, you've got quite a bit of salvation thematic material in it, just because that's how the story goes. A lot of these stories end up going that way. I wonder why. But it's well done. That's a credit to the source material too, because the book was written well, and the series was written well. And the original cast of this film grew very strongly into the roles that they played and totally inhabited those roles. And that's what makes the finale so powerful.
Yeah.
It's just a good movie, period.
Yeah. And the thing you see as you watch the Harry Potter films, they start out very on the childish wonder element, and they just get progressively deeper, more mature, even darker as they go on. And the culmination of that is the Deathly Hallows Part 2. And you get that real conflict of good versus evil, the real facement, the real dealing with and doing what's necessary to conquer evil on this front. And you get to see the full culminations of these characters that you've lived with for, you know, what is it, 8 movies and 7 books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very fitting end. It's a very fitting tribute to the characters and the source material, and getting to finally see the big showdowns and see how it goes from there. So it just really is a blockbuster in the truest sense of the word, in terms of like big action sequences, lots of things, but it also brings in the kind of the best of the franchise element, where you're getting to conclude something and a major storyline and do it well, which is really sometimes very hard. Yeah. So that was my number 7 movie, the Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. That was number seven. Number six for me is Crazy Stupid Love. I
Not
know.
on my list.
See, this is one I just keep coming back to, and I know I've talked about it a little bit on the podcast before, but the characters, the casting, it's really excellent. I love the multi-storyline aspect, and it has one of the funniest, one of the best payoff scenes when all those storylines intermix towards the end, and it's just pure chaos in all the best possible ways. And it's just a really fun, really cool movie. It's got some good relationships, some bad relationships, some that are trying to work their way through it. So it's a lot of a mixture of comedy, drama, relationship things at all sorts of different levels of relationships. So there's a lot actually in it. Ryan Gosling and Steve Carell play in this one, and I think they do an excellent job. And again, this is chemistry between two male actors. I think that like those two as a pair works really, really well because they play off each other because they are almost diabolically opposite in terms of physical stature, age, you know, all those type of things. And it works. It just works. It works so well as those two pair together. So Crazy Stupid
So
Love.
Steve Carell is notoriously handsome, and Ryan Gosling is a little.
Yeah, you know. Number five for me is Super 8. And this is where we start to go into where I think there's some like really key things. And don't for like I think Super 8 was just so good. It's like one of those like reasons you go to cinema adventure things. It falls in nicely with that class of like coming of age drama. So you have like The Sandlot, or you had Stand By Me, or you had like that those group of young kids who are, you know, out in the world trying to do something. Like there's a bunch of good films in the genre, and this is the next one in that. So it kind of plays on the alien thing, you know, similar to E.T. and some of those type of films, the adventure films, the coming of age films. There's a lot to this. And it's packed in the kind of 80s, like an 80s theme there. And I don't think you get Stranger Things if Super 8 hadn't been a success. I think a lot of that kind of relaunch of like the 80s nostalgia done really well with Stranger Things, done really terribly with Wonder Woman 84. But I think a lot of that interest sparked with Super 8. So I think that's its kind of claim to fame. And of course, J.J. Abrams, I think, did an excellent job there.
Yeah.
Four, three, two.
My number four is Captain America, the First Avenger. We already talked extensively about it, but if I had to rank my favorite Marvel movies, it would be in the top three. Another Marvel movie came out this year, which did not make my list or my honorable mentions, Thor, which is in itself not a bad movie,
No.
but Captain America is by far a better movie.
Yeah.
Chris Evans just totally inhabits this character. Like, he is Captain America. And what's really cool is seeing the development of that, seeing him grow literally physically before you, because he actually does start out as a weakling.
Yeah.
And then gets the serum and becomes the fully realized version of this character.
Yeah.
And it's done in a way that doesn't seem completely corny. And that in itself is an achievement, because by all rights, it's kind of a corny idea.
Yeah.
A lot of the comic book stories in general are corny ideas.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Marvel and Disney and everyone involved in that deserves a lot of credit, because they managed to make it have some gravity
Yeah.
to it. And the First Avenger is probably the best example of that kind of filmmaking. And I really appreciated how the Captain America character developed over time, and it needed this as a grounding point. for that development. So that's one of the reasons why, a few of the reasons why it's so high on my list.
Nice.
My number three, I'd be shocked if it's not on your list. Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol.
Yep.
Number three. This is my favorite Mission Impossible movie. It's a little hard for me not to rate it higher. And my number two movie is objectively not a better movie. It's just a movie that I have fallen in love with and have watched a bajillion times. And it's just it's a movie that I've enjoyed with my family and friends. And so we'll talk about that shortly. But Ghost Protocol just has so many great scenes in it, so much amazing action. From the very beginning with the Kremlin, like all the way through the end of the movie, it's just a nonstop. And to me, the what makes it the best, my favorite Mission Impossible movie is I think it really just has the Mission Impossible ethos running through it entirely from start to finish in a way that I thought they captured, honestly, I thought they captured some of that in the most recent one, which was cool to see. But I
Yeah.
think this one did it the best, is my argument. Maybe you can make an argument the first one did because it is the first one. But this one for me is stronger just because of the development of everything that happens in it and all the characters, character arcs that led them to where they are in this movie.
Yeah.
And it just completely paid off.
For sure.
And it's just phenomenal. Phenomenal movie. I would have to say it's probably above average. Above average. It's a great movie. And my number two might not even be on your list. That's okay because it's just a movie I love, and it's Rango, and it's Johnny Depp playing a wizard. And the reason why this is number two on my list is this movie is a perfect send-up of the spaghetti western, done in animated form. And basically, Johnny Depp's lizard character is Clint Eastwood, just inhabited as a lizard. And it's got great music all throughout. It's hilarious. The setting in the middle of the desert in this town with no water, where all these animals, the only currency they have is water. They're trying to figure out where all the water is gone. It turns out Las Vegas is stealing it. And Johnny Depp's lizard character wanders out into the wilderness and comes across the Spirit of the West, which is actually basically Clint Eastwood driving a golf cart. And as he drives away, he's got like five Emmys hanging out of the golf cart. Like, it's very clearly supposed to be him. It's really funny because he's got like the poncho on and he's got the slung down cowboy hat and he's giving him advice. And it just has so many funny one-liners all throughout the movie. And it's pretty much, for me, it's like the perfect animated movie. I could watch this movie probably every day, and never get tired. There's little things all throughout it. And Johnny Depp is at his hammy best in this role, playing this lizard who is so serious. And he's an actor, and he thinks that he has landed a role when he comes into this town, and he's playing the sheriff character. But it turns out they actually think he's the sheriff, and they think he's killed all the bad guys, which he tells them he has. And they find out that he hasn't. Well, he's actually just been pretending the whole time. Oh man, it's just, I can't even adequately describe it. But if you have not seen it, you should watch Rango. And I will say this, by no means does it have any business being a number two on the top 10 list of movies of the year, but I love it so much that I can't help it. So it's my number two.
There you go. There you go. Number four for me was Drive.
Ooh, good
Ryan
movie.
Gosling, getaway driver, stunt driver, movie. And I did not actually, I had missed this in 2011. I watched this for the first time like a couple years ago. I was like, oh man, how did I miss this film? And it's like classic Ryan Gosling, like under, like playing the reserved character actor. He has a lot of range, but he does this particular role, like this, the silent, calm type. He does that really well. But in some interesting things about this film, it was one of the last films shot before LA switched their lights over to LEDs. And so much of the film is like shots of Los Angeles and driving through, and all has this kind of yellow incandescent light glow. And it's one of the last movies that could be shot that way because everything else changed to the more bright white look and feel. So it kind of is like the end of an era of LA movies, and it really leaned into that sort of tones and light as you go throughout the film. So it's kind of an interesting historical film from that standpoint. How it really leaned into that as one of the last films, like the end of an era of Los Angeles was kind of captured in this film. The soundtrack is also really good. It has some really kind of well-known, famous kind of electronic undertones to it. And that is really popular, and it's a soundtrack that has done really, really well. And of course, you got Ryan Gosling, whose Night Call is the specific song that is it's most known for. But it's just a really interesting movie, and it's up there in the films because this is actually a fairly popular genre, like the getaway driver, car type movie, and it's a really good entry to that. Number three for me was Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol. I will echo a lot of what you said about the film. I think this is the best one because I think it best captures the combination of what the Mission Impossible movies, the heist element, the action, the high flying action adventures, but it also added an element of humor. And I think it let all of the characters be their absolute best as a result of the shifting. You had heavy action, you got drama, you got emotional sentiment, but you also got those light touches of humor, and the balance of it is just such a well-balanced film in terms of tone and genre, and serious versus humor, action versus downtime. I think it nails it. Not to mention, I think there are two main stunts. When you think of Mission Impossible, there are two stunts that you think of primarily, first and foremost: the vault scene from the first one, and the Dubai and the climbing the outside of the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. And of course, that one is in this particular film. And given the fact that this was Brad Bird's first live action film, is incredible. I mean, he just nailed it. He absolutely nailed it and set them up for the rest of the films take more of the tone from Ghost Protocol than they do from any of the previous three movies from that point going forward. Number two for me, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It is on my list of top movies of all time. It does, you're right in that it does an incredible job of sticking to the book, but does it in such a way. The book is unbelievably compelling, and you would think as you read it and think about how would you make that, it would be very possible to make it very much like the book and make it lack drama and be boring. But this is where David Fincher, the director, is such an expert, is that he manages to constantly keep it moving and constantly keep the drama up. He knew what to leave out from the book and what to keep in and how to manage that so well. And I love the iterations of these characters. I love Daniel Craig as the main character. I loved Rooney Mara in her role as well. It's such a good film. Everything about it. I mean, it is dark. Like it is a At times, it's uncomfortably dark, and there's a lot in it. It's an intense film, but it's so well done. Like I said, Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor did the score for this one, and they are masters of doing scores. And this was still early in their career. They had just kind of started the year before, I think the year before, with the Facebook movie, the
That's so cool.
social network. And this was their second one, and they just nailed it again. So really, really good stuff for that one. All right, number one.
So we started off this podcast by saying it was not a baseball podcast, Ryan, but I have a feeling we both have the same movie at number one, which
You
would be
do.
Moneyball.
Moneyball. That's right.
Moneyball is number one because it opened up a world previously inhabited only by us nerds to the whole world and brought people in a way that made them appreciate and understand something that is so nerdy. Like, you could not get more nerdy than bet on base percentage is the most important thing in baseball. You can't get more nerdy than that. And it literally completely revolutionized the game to the point that it's still doing it. And people, there's like, it got so popular and now there's a backlash against it. Like, it became more than a movement. It became the way of doing things, period, in the sport, which is kind of insane because for most of the history of the sport, it was the exact opposite. And then you had this one guy come in and say, no, it should actually be this way. Obviously, based a lot on the thought processes and study of Bill James is where a lot of this came from. But somebody had to put that thought process into action and make it not just a thought experiment. And that's what Billy Beane did with the Oakland A's. Changed the game forever, and the movie is phenomenal. The book is phenomenal. And it's what's really the thing I love about this movie is you can show this to someone who doesn't know anything about baseball. They might not come away loving baseball, but they'll go away saying that it was a good movie because it was. And maybe you'll get them to like baseball too. Who knows?
Yeah, and I think there's just some really great scenes in this one and some deep scenes. Like there's one where he's contemplating trading their rookie first baseman who's probably going to be an all-star, and his assistant GM is kind of like, if you do this, like this is the move, this is a move that gets people fired. And he looks at him, he's like, yeah, if we get fired, you have an MBA from Harvard or wherever Ivy League school he was from, and I'm a 40-year-old guy who's never done anything but baseball. He's like, so what are we talking about here? He's like, do you believe in this or you don't you? You know? And it's kind of a really cool moment of like, okay, sometimes you gotta push all the chips in. You gotta decide, is this what we believe in or isn't it? And so just some really cool scenes like that, some really cool moments. Talking about those things, it is like if you're a baseball person, you'll love it. If you're not a baseball person, there's so much in it from a human standpoint and a human drama standpoint, and that idea of leadership and trying to make things better and trying to make things work and pushing against the tide is really captivating, and they do an amazing job of that in this film. All right. Well, that is the best movies from 2011, folks. And I am grateful to discuss it. Let's move on briefly to our watch list movies we've watched recently.
So most recently, I watched the movie Passenger, which came out, which I think might be my favorite scary movie of the year so far. Very cool concept about what happens to people who are lost on the road, and what's the role of mythology in this? What's the role of Saint Christopher in this, or the patron saint of travelers? Some really cool stuff. Some pretty wild out there stuff. However, not as wild and out there as Obsession, which I have to say I'm shocked made as much money as it did because that movie is chaotic. It's how I would describe it. Because the concept is the guy has a wish and wishes that this girl would fall in love with him more than anyone else in the entire world, and she proceeds to lose her ever living mind. And it is disturbing and it is crazy. And after watching it, I was like, yeah, this movie will probably make like $30 million total. So the fact that it's made already over $60 million, Bruce, I don't really know what I'm talking about. But out of all the scary movies I've seen, this is not the one that I would have picked to make that kind of money. So
Yeah.
take that for what you will. But I've also talked to a lot of people who thought it was really cool. So apparently it's the word of mouth is spreading
Definitely.
on it. I also did see The Sheep Detectives, which I thoroughly enjoyed and think is a phenomenal family movie. If you want to go to a movie with your family, I would highly recommend it. The best thing in the movie is the sheep discussing who God is. I found I'll leave that up to you to see yourself because it's really funny.
Looked like a
And
very good movie.
it is a classic. Like it reminded it very. Did you see this too?
I have not seen it, but I was interested.
Yeah, it reminded me very much of like a kid movie like we watched growing up, like Animal Stalking, like just like a wholesome movie. Like there's death in it, but it's presented in a way that like we're trying to figure out what happened and not dwell on the negative thoughts and emotions that come up with things. But also how do we deal with reality when things are not the way that we think they are. I will say this one, this is just one example of the humor in the movie, that there are two sheep about to cross the road and they're terrified because they've never been on anything other than grass. And they won't go across the road. And they're like, what if we do it together? Well, like, being really close together and they're about to cross the road. And right before they can take a step on the road, no dialogue whatsoever, a chicken just crosses the road next to them and just keeps walking. And they don't say anything about it. And it's like, it's phenomenal. Like, it's just perfect.
Nice.
I was like, the chicken just crossed the road. Amazing.
Nice.
I also saw a movie. The movie Is God Is. Which is also very weird. What?
Yeah.
Know much to say about that one. That one was just that was out there. But this is why I enjoy going to movies, because some of them are taken by surprise and some of them disappoint you. But out of all the movies I've seen recently, The Sheep Detectives was the best. Take that for what you will.
For me, I did see The Devil Wears Prada 2, and I enjoyed it. Yeah, I thought it was good. I think the couple things that stood out to me, one was they were managed to craft an original story that wove the characters together without feeling like they were treading too much on past ground and relying too heavily on tropes from the previous movie, which I think is sometimes difficult to do. And the second thing I thought was good about it was the fact that they really did create compelling characters for that original film. And I found it was like, oh yeah, I do want to see what happens to these characters. I do want to see where they're at now. So I think it caused me to also to reflect on the original movie and how strong the characters were in the original film, that I was really curious to see where they were at and what they were doing. And I did enjoy seeing those characters back again. So that's most of what I got to say about that one.
I mean, it also helped that Kenneth Branagh showed up.
Yeah.
Kenneth Branagh is always a good addition.
I saw The Mandalorian and Grogu. My general things without trying to give any spoilers away, I did think it was fun. It was entertaining. I didn't take it too seriously. And I think my critiques of it would be largely my same critiques of The Mandalorian show. And so I don't want to go too much into that, but I came away with the same feeling of, okay, that's the story. Okay. And that's
Would someone who isn't versed in the show be able to follow the movie?
Follow the movie, yes. Kind of know any of the background on any of these guys, a little bit. Like if you've seen like even the first season, you're good. You're good for the film. I think you can pick up what's going on if you have some level of Star Wars lore. But they don't really spend a lot of time on the two main characters and giving you much of any backstory for them. There are little hints of it here or there, but they don't really try to bring along an audience not familiar with the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a reason why it's not super popular in
Yeah.
terms of Star Wars movies. Lastly, I saw Brave the Dark, the movie that came out last year. It was actually filmed largely in Lancaster and Lancaster County, about a teacher from Garden Spot High School locally here and a student, troubled student that he takes in. And so I've missed it in theaters, and I did get a finally get a chance to see it. And it's fun watching a feature film that, has shots of buildings you walk by every single day, which is kind of cool. It must be what it's like living in New York City. But
Yeah.
it's a good story. It's a good story. It's a fun story. It's not a fun story. It's a good story. And they're Jared Harris is the main actor here. He does a great job in the film. He's always a good actor. And it's compelling and it's interesting. And if you're from Lancaster County, you'll recognize quite a few things. So it's worth checking out if you have not seen it. All right, that is the show, everyone. Thanks for checking out Film for Fans. Make sure you visit filmforfans.com, like, subscribe, tell your friends. Until next time, enjoy the movies.